shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
You have summoned me on behalf of millions of your fellow Americans to lead a great crusade for freedom in America and freedom in the world. I know something of the solemn responsibility of leading a crusade. I have led one.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
History seems compellingly alive as we hear the authentic voices of the great men of America's past and present. Let us listen now to the voices and songs, the cheers, the debated issues, the moments of greatness, and the moments of defeat that have shaped the political history of the United States in the 20th century. Probably the first campaign speech recorded was one made by Grover Cleveland, the Democratic candidate for president, in 1892.
My friends, we shall declare that this nation is able to legislate for its own people on every question without waiting for the aid or consent of any other nation on earth. Upon that issue, we expect to carry every single state in this union.
In 1893, 2 months after Cleveland became president for the second time, a severe financial depression swept over the country. Cleveland believed in the gold standard, but gold was scarce, and its scarcity created a steady break on the nation's economy. By 1894, prices and wages had hit rock bottom. There seemed to be no market for anything. There was a massive railroad strike, and high tariffs had brought the nation to the brink of economic disaster. In the campaign of 1896, gold was a key issue. The Democrats nominated William Jennings Bryan, and he campaigned on a platform of free silver, in which he demanded that the U.S. currency be backed with silver as well as gold. At the Democratic Convention of 1896, Bryan delivered his famous impassioned Cross of Gold speech.
I come to speak to you in defense of a cause as holy as the cause of liberty, the cause of humanity. Mr. Carlyle said in 1878, that this was a struggle between the idle holders of idle capital and the struggling masses who produce the wealth and pay the taxes of the country. They tell us that the great cities are in favor of the gold standard. We reply that the great cities rest upon our broad and fertile prairies. Burn down your cities and leave our farms, and your cities will spring up again as if by magic. But destroy our farms, and the grass will grow in the streets of every city of the country. If they dare to come out in the open field and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we will fight them to the uttermost. Having behind us the producing masses of this nation and the world, supported by the commercial interests, the laboring interests, and the toilers everywhere, we will answer their demand for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold.
Taking a strong stand against the easy money, free silver platform of the agrarian Democrats, the Republicans ardently supported the gold standard and nominated William McKinley for president. McKinley promised to exercise the severest economy and to avoid government debt.
What a glory that will be when we beat old Grover C. McKinley takes the road to Washington. What a welcome change there'll be, we'll regain prosperity. McKinley and protection marches on.
McKinley won, and a year after he took office, the country began to turn its attention from domestic affairs to the world outside. In 1898, the United States became embroiled in a war with Spain, which ended with the Spanish evacuation of Cuba and the United States' acquisition of Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines.
Our eyes have seen fair Cuba with 400,000 been slain. We have seen our slaughtered seamen, we have seen the stricken main. And the hand that wrought the ruin was the dastard hand of Spain. Our host is marching on.
In the election campaigns following the Spanish-American War, imperialism was an important issue. Stated the Democratic platform in 1900, the burning issues of imperialism growing out of the Spanish War involve the very existence of the Republic and the destruction of our free institutions. We regard it as the paramount issue of the campaign. We assert that no nation can long endure half republic and half empire. And we warn the American people that imperialism abroad will lead quickly and inevitably to despotism at home. Other important issues were the tariff, the Democrats favoring tariff reform, and the trusts. A Democratic platform plank flatly declared that private monopolies are indefensible and intolerable. In a campaign speech of 1908, William Howard Taft, the Republican candidate for president, defends the Republican point of view on these three issues: imperialism, the tariff, and the trusts. He also refers to the traditional split in the Democratic Party between Southerners and Northerners.
Many independent Democrats in the South agree with the Republican Party in all its main economic doctrines. And the South is today in its cotton factory, in its iron factory, and in the sugar culture of Louisiana, more dependent for its business prosperity on the maintenance of a reasonable protective tariff than any other community in the country. The Spanish War led to the entering of the flower of the young men of the South into the Army of the United States in order to uphold the country's cause. This did much to remove sectional feelings lingering after the Civil War and served to unite in a common brotherhood the blue and the gray. Many of the Southern Democrats have taken an active interest in promoting our present Philippine policy, and more are in sympathy with it. They are opposed to the policy of shuffling out of the Philippines. They generally believe that we have a problem of national responsibility there, of aiding those people to stand upon their feet, and that we ought not to leave the island until we have fully completed our work. They rejoice in the missionary character of what we are doing and in the spread of Christian civilization that we are helping on by our policy in the Philippines. So too, they have not the slightest sympathy with that spirit of the Democratic platform favoring a destruction of certain industrial interests for the purpose of stamping out the evil in their conduct rather than their regulation with a view to bringing them within the law.
Taft won the election easily, defeating Democrat Bryan, who was running for the third time. In the beginning of his administration, Taft tried to continue the policies of his predecessor and friend, Teddy Roosevelt. But within 2 years, he seemed to many to have abandoned Roosevelt's enlightened views. In desperation, T.R. decided to run against his one-time friend for the Republican presidential nomination in 1912. Taft commented sadly that it was a very painful thing to see a devoted friendship going to pieces like a rope of sand. The ensuing party fight was bitter. The battle between Taft and Roosevelt wrecked the Republican convention, and when Roosevelt lost, he pledged himself to run anyway on an independent progressive ticket.
The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically, a square deal in manners social and industrial.
A madman shot at Roosevelt while he was delivering a campaign speech in Milwaukee. T.R. kept right on talking. "I will make this speech or die," he announced dramatically. Fortunately, the bullet had hit his spectacle case, and he was not seriously injured. The fight between Taft and Roosevelt divided the Republicans and ensured victory for the Democratic nominee, Governor Woodrow Wilson of New Jersey. In this campaign speech, Wilson attacks Teddy Roosevelt and his views on labor.
To look at the politics of the day from the viewpoint of the laboring man is not to suggest that there is one view proper to him, another to the employer, another to the capitalist, another to the professional man, but merely that the life of the country as a whole may be looked at from various points of view and yet be viewed as a whole. The whole business of politics is to bring classes together upon a platform of accommodation and common interest. In a political campaign, the voters are called upon to choose between parties and leaders. Parties and platforms and candidates should be frankly put under examination to see what they will yield us by way of progress. And there are a great many questions which the working man may legitimately ask and press until he gets a definite answer. The predictions of the leader of the new party are as alarming as the predictions of the various Sam Patter. He declares that he is not troubled by the fact that a very large amount of money is taken out of the pockets of the general taxpayer and put into the pocket of particular classes of protected manufacturers, but that his concern is that so little of this money gets into the pocket of the laboring man, and so large a proportion of it into the pockets of the employer. I have searched his program very thoroughly for an indication of what he expects to do in order to see to it that a larger proportion of this prize money gets into the pay envelope, and I have found only one suggestion. There is a plank in the program which speaks of establishing a minimum or living wage for women workers, and I suppose that we may assume that the principle is not in the long run meant to be confined in its application to women only. Perhaps we are justified in assuming that the third party looks forward to the general establishment by law of a minimum wage. It is very likely, I take it for granted, that if a minimum wage were established by law, the great majority of employers would take occasion to bring their wage scale as nearly as might be down to the level of that minimum. And it would be very awkward for the working man to resist that process successfully, because it would be dangerous to strike against the authority of the federal government.
Roosevelt replies,
"We stand for the rights of the people. We stand for the rights of the wage worker. We stand for his right to a living wage. We stand for the right and duty of the government to limit the hours of women in industry, to abolish child labor, to shape the conditions of life and living so that the average wage worker shall be able so to lead his own life and so to support his wife and his children, that these children shall grow up into men and women fit for the exacting duties of American citizenship."
When Wilson began his term in 1913, domestic issues and domestic reform took precedence. But by 1916 and the next election campaign, when he defeated Republican Charles Evans Hughes, Wilson's concern was with foreign policy. At the height of his popularity during World War I, he later found the country divided and indifferent to his pleas for a League of Nations. Wilson's second term was to put the mark of tragedy upon him. He campaigned personally throughout the country for support for the League, but in this, his opponents saw a chance to defeat him and the Democratic Party. By 1920, Wilson, seriously ill, looked to the election for vindication of his principles. But the presidential candidate of his party, Governor James Cox of Ohio, and the vice presidential candidate, a certain Franklin Delano Roosevelt of New York, were easily defeated. The nation was not in a mood for internationalism and idealism. The people preferred the philosophy of gentleman Warren Harding, the Republican candidate, who promised a return to normalcy. "America's present need is not heroics, but healing," he said. "Not nostrums, but normalcy. Not revolution, but restoration." The main positive accomplishment of Harding's administration was the International Conference on Limitation of Armaments, which resulted in the curtailment of shipbuilding among the major powers, and for more than a decade kept the danger of an armaments race in check. Warren Harding addresses that conference, convened in 1921, the year he became president.
"Gentlemen of the conference, the United States welcomes you with unselfish hands. We harbor no fears. We have no sordid ends to serve. We suspect no enemy. We contemplate or apprehend no conquest. Content with what we have, we seek nothing which is another's. We only wish to do with you that finer, nobler thing which no nation can do alone. We wish to sit with you at the table of international understanding and goodwill. In good conscience, we are eager to meet you frankly and invite and offer cooperation. The world demands a sober contemplation of the existing order and the realization that there can be no cure without sacrifice, not by one of us, but by all of us. I do not mean surrendered rights or narrowed freedom or denied aspirations or ignored national necessities. Our republic would no more ask for these than it would give. No pride need be humbled, no nationality submerged. But I would have emergence of minds committing all of us to less preparation for war and more enjoyment of fortunate peace.
From then on, Harding's administration went slowly downhill, climaxing in the Teapot Dome scandal with its revelations of corruption in high places and in Harding's mysterious death in 1923. Harding's vice president, Calvin Coolidge, took his oath of office as president in his family's modest Vermont farmhouse and within a short time set about preaching and practicing economy. I am for economy. After that, I am for more economy. At the time and under present conditions, that is my conception of serving the people. The motto of his 1924 campaign against Democrat John W. Davis and progressive Robert M. La Follette was, "Keep cool and keep Coolidge." The president pledged a continuation of his economic policies.
Our domestic problems are, for the most part, economic. We have an enormous debt to pay, and we are paying it. We have the high cost of government to diminish, and we are diminishing it. We have a heavy burden of taxation to reduce, and we are reducing it. But while remarkable progress has been made in these directions, the work is yet far from accomplished. In my opinion, the government can do more to remedy the economic ills of the people by a rigid economy in public expenditure than through any other action. The annual costs of our national and local governments combined now stand at a sum close to $100 for each inhabitant of the land. It is an ominous fact that only the national government is reducing its debt. The establishment of a system of drastic economy in public expenditures, which has enabled us to pay off about one-fifth of the national debt since 1919 and almost cut into the national tax burden since 1921, has been one of the main causes in reestablishing the prosperity which has come to include within its benefits almost every one of our inhabitants. Economy reaches everywhere.
When Coolidge made his famous pronouncement, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928, he left the Republicans in confusion. Some say Coolidge foresaw the Great Depression, others that he was hoping for a draft. Whatever his reasons, his statement left the Republican convention to nominate Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce under both Harding and Coolidge. The Houston Democratic Convention, which chose the governor of New York, Alfred E. Smith, will have its place in history chiefly for this famous moment in which Franklin D. Roosevelt places the name of Smith in nomination.
We offer one who has the will to win, who not only deserves success, but commands it. Victory is his habit. The happy warrior, Alfred E. Smith.
East, west, north, south, oh say can you see? Al Smith is in his glory neath the presidential tree. Choice of all the people, everybody's old pal. Three big cheers for our leader, everybody loves our Al.
Herbert Hoover's candidacy inspired this famous jingle.
Charles Lindbergh flew his plane
all the way to France. Most of the way he flew by the seat of his pants. A good old American know-how, that's the right way to be. And if he's good enough for Lindbergh, he's good enough for me.
If he's good enough for Lindy, he's good enough for me. If he's good enough for Lindy, he's good enough for me. If he's good enough for Lindy, he's good enough for me. Herbert Hoover is the only man to be our nation's chief.
Al Smith campaigned on an anti-prohibition ticket, but with a vice presidential candidate, Senator Joseph T. Robinson of Arkansas, who was strongly prohibitionist. As one wag put it, the Democratic donkey with a wet head and wagging a dry tail left Houston. Smith lashes out at prohibition.
Now let's look at the record. Prohibition has found a new line of endeavor for the underworld. They brought life to the bootleggers, and the bootleggers begot the hijackers, and the hijackers begot the racketeers. My friends of the radio audience, the only cure for the ills of democracy is more democracy.
Hoover won an impressive victory in which an important factor was Al Smith's Catholicism. It has also been said that Smith's radio voice didn't help his candidacy. When Hoover took office in 1929, the nation was at the height of a prosperity wave. But 7 months later, the stock market crumbled, losing billions upon billions in value. The Great Depression had begun.
7 cent cotton and a 40 cent meat. How in the world can a poor man eat? Flour up high and cotton down low. How in the world can we raise the dough? Clothes worn out, shoes run down, old slouch hat with a hole in the crown, back nearly broken and fingers all sore, cotton gone down to rise no more.
In 1932, Franklin D. Roosevelt, then governor of New York, was the man for the Democrats. Will Rogers at the Democratic Convention.
I was asked to do this by one of the Roosevelt boys. You know that nobody ever could refuse Roosevelt. His principal political handicap is that he was educated at Harvard. But I understand he has forgotten most of that, so that brings him back to earth. On account of his wealth, he is the only man in the campaign that you can accept a cigar from and smoke it yourself. He is the only man in Congress who owns his own best suit. He is the only politician outside of Henry Cabot Lodge that can get into the front door of a Fifth Avenue home without delivering something. I thank you.
Roosevelt waged a vigorous campaign. I pledge you, I pledge myself, said the candidate, to a new deal for the American people. Listen now to the voice of FDR and some of the famous election, campaign, and inaugural speeches of his career. Roosevelt's inaugural, March 4th, 1933.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
In 1936, Roosevelt carried every state but two, Maine and Vermont, winning all but 8 electoral votes. His Republican opponent, Governor Alfred Landon of Kansas.
You've all heard the story of the Kansas tornado leaving nothing behind. The wife came to find her husband laughing. She asked him, "What are you laughing at, you old fool?" He replied, "The completeness of it."
Back again.
Back again.
Back again.
Back again.
We've got Franklin D. Roosevelt back again. Since Roosevelt's been elected, moonshine liquor's been corrected. We've got legal wine, whiskey, beer, and gin. Back again.
Back again.
Back again.
Roosevelt sounded a more somber note in his inaugural speech in 1937.
So let us ask again, have we reached the goal of our vision of that fourth day of March, 1933? have we found our happy valley. I see a great nation upon a great continent, blessed with a great wealth of national resources. Its 130 million people are at peace among themselves. They are making their country a good neighbor among the nations. I see a United States which can demonstrate that under democratic methods of government, national wealth can be translated into a spreading volume of human comfort hitherto unknown, and the lowest standard of living can be raised far above the level of mere subsistence. But here is the challenge to our democracy. In this nation, I see tens of millions of its citizens, a substantial part of its whole population, who at this very moment are denied the greater part of what the very lowest standards of today call the necessities of life. I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.